before we... Well, I mean,
oh, yeah, I guess we can catch it on the Erev Tov, good to be back after a week of a break. You know, the President's Day week was a holiday, so just some calendaring and housekeeping. So this month, obviously, is still the end of February, but March is coming. So obviously, class is going to roll forward. March 13th, since he's a member of our class, we can say Mazal Tov to Jay and Leslie, his wife, on being honorees, among others, at the Schechter Manhattan dinner, the dinner that benefits Solomon Schechter of Manhattan. Of course, my children go there, and I can vouch this year that it's quite the school for continuing this culture, along with the other day schools that people have supported in our community, Heschel and Ramaz and Manhattan Day and the academies that are here, the yeshivas. The culture of our Beit Midrash, nothing parallels it like the induction that kids get, not just sitting in standard yeshiva, but in the world of Jewish day school, which is different than yeshiva. In America, for the first time 3 years ago, the yeshiva movement of day schools, not the Haredi, not the ultra-Orthodox, the Solomon Schechter and the Reform Network of Jewish Day Schools all had one conference. That was in Teaneck, New Jersey. That national day school conference has proceeded over years to unite movements of day school children to create cultures like this and appreciation for cultures like ours, so that, God willing, there will be Talmud learning into the future and intellectual Jewish pride, in addition to just Jewish cultural connection. Because it's one thing to think Jewishly, it's another thing to light candles. And both are amazingly important, but the notion that Jewish insight and ways of questioning and study really make a difference in life happen because schools are based in a curriculum that's thousands of years old, and they match it up with whatever the current fare of educational curricula really are in the world in which we found ourselves throughout history, let alone today. I mention that because I think we should all, in our own way, support that culture, either through tzedakah or attending the dinner, March 13th, Wednesday night. But I was talking with some folks about the culture of what happens on nights. I personally am attending that dinner, so that'll be Wednesday night, March 13th. But I've invited a great substitute teacher, so you could also spread word if you're not coming to the dinner. We'll have a substitute teacher that night. Rabbi Danny Nevins will be coming, who's the dean of the Jewish Theological Seminary Rabbinical School, who will be presenting some of his latest work on looking at the learning the daily daf differently. And there's a movement, of course, to learn the daily daf. I learned the daf yomi, the daily daf of Gemara. We're in Shabbat right now, in the 140s or so. There's a movement that runs through that daf very quickly, and you can either get a shiur or a lesson or a lecture about it in 15 minutes, 18 minutes, or 47 minutes, depending on how long your train ride is. You can plug in, open your Gemara. And then there's a group that looks at one aspect of the page and goes deeper into it and doesn't really care so much about getting all the parlance and all of the logic and argumentation of the page. Danny is uniquely positioned because he's presenting on a website that ultimately looks at the daily daf differently. He has some material that he'll bring, using, and I've explained to him our traditional fashion of text, both Hebrew and translation, and I think you'll have a wonderful time getting to know him as a teacher, and I hope it's only the first of many introductions that I have to give Danny. I won't be able to do it here in person, but those of you can be my ambassadors. I'll mention it again weeks to come. He's really a fantastic teacher. So, spread the word.
What's his family name again?
Nevins. N-E-V-I-N-S.
Thank you.
Rabbi Daniel Nevins. And Jay, if I could ask you to get an email about the schedule for March that says we have Shirim, and then on that Wednesday, guest lecturer, we're honored to have Rabbi Nevins. I'll coordinate with you. So that's the housekeeping notion. The other is, before we begin, just to bring us back into the mindset, we're in Ben Sorer Moreya, 8th chapter of Sanhedrin, and I want to open our Gemaras. We had done the first Mishnah regarding the rebellious and stubborn child, went through legal parlance, and we're in a sugya that highlights the position in a certain way of Rabbah, or at least challenges it, that a minor cannot father a child. So what difference does it make if a minor can or cannot father a child? It depends on how you see the text sometimes, what meaning you make of it. And other times, what you make of life then either necessitates or creates the need for a way of reading text and making limudim, making hermeneutical understandings and legal reasoning happen out of the text based on your understanding of reality. Listen to the difference again. It's a very different kind of reading. I could read the text and make meaning of it, and depending on my milieu, and depending on me as a reader, and depending on my level of literacy, and depending on my desire to look at the text, I can make learning come out of it. But then, sometimes my understanding of reality either allows me or forces me to read text in a certain way and use a text in a holy tradition of textual analysis to either support something or reject something of a law, because necessarily I believe this.
Isn't that the difference between reading in and reading out?
In a short form, I think that's a great way to put it. It's exegesis or eisegesis. It's reading in, reading out. The example here is this. If I'm Rabbah and I think that a minor cannot father a child, then the word ben, if it means a minor, right? I don't have to worry about the phrase in Hebrew, v'lo av, and not a father. I don't have to worry about that phrase needing to come to really tell me anything about what it means to be a ben. You with me? If I have the word son and not a father, or child and not a father, I can read the word child not meaning a child who has not yet become a father, because I don't believe a child or someone in this category of ben, person who hasn't really reached the full status of adulthood, being able to inseminate. I don't have to modulate my understanding of that with the phrase v'lo av. V'lo av can remain something else in a hermeneutical system. But in a hermeneutical system that only allows for me to make some type of law based in proof texts, v'lo av has to come necessarily to give me a way of understanding the word ben if I'm in this gray area of how old is this child. So fundamentally, I wanted to move us back with that bird's eye view in terms of some of the sugiatic work going on. This is kind of the poetry of understanding how the rabbis read, what kind of understanding they need to come up with of language within Torah. At the heart of the argument sometimes feels too like they want to test out other legal concepts that come to bear, that come into play through the situations that arise within our own categorical discussion. We're going to see some of that today. I want to try to push through a bunch of text and get into some parallel texts or texts that come up with legal discussions that are important for us that are referenced and part of the discussion here without being exactly on our pages. We are holding We just read about, if I'm remembering right, that a man's body is good because it cooks up the seed, right? And a person at his full capacity of potential childbearing is actually called an ish, and that person is a kind of ben gaining that power. And so I'm on page 69A1. The last little piece, the Gemara asks, Rav Mordechai said to Rav Ashi, how is it known that this word mazid, Amar le Rav Mordechai le Rav Ashi? Yeah? You found it there? You with me? Amar le Rav Mordechai le Rav Ashi, my mashma dahai mezi lishna de vishulehu. How do we know that this word mezi has the connotation of cooking, referring back to what was learned before in a braita just above that, that says, devei chizki atana v'chi yazid ish, if a man will act intentionally, and that's talking about acting against a man to kill him, when it could have said instead, if a man will act wickedly. In other words, instead of just saying v'chi yazid, he purports that it would have said v'chi yashia, when he does something wicked, but he says it acts intentionally, ish mezid umazriya. Since scripture chose this yazid, this word intentionality, behind the evil act of killing, I'm going to say that a person becomes an intentional kind of person and then gives seed, or what? A man's body cooks sperm and then is able to inseminate. Meaning what? That over time, when one becomes bar mitzvah, there's a certain period of time that a person gains that full strength. We've called that to the person's gevurah, to a person's strength. And then the person really becomes able to inseminate and have and father children. And they say cook here in the translation because of what we are saying down below it, which is, oh, you mean by intentionality that the body intentionally prepares the seed, we call that cooking. And how do we make that parallel that this word mazid, intentionality, has any kind of cooking? Because we liken it to what we learned, if you turn to page 69A2, dichtiv, because it's written, v'yazed Yaakov nazid, Jacob cooked a stew, right? When the term is that Jacob cooks this kind of stew, the stew being a cooked set of lentils and beans and this kind of thing, indicates cooking. Now the interesting piece to note is that this kind of dichtiv is not necessarily a textual proof in the same legalistic way that a pasuk is sometimes, a verse is sometimes broken down. It's a linguistic connection, but still introduced by dichtiv, as it's written. Okay. Now we're going to challenge Rabba's position again that a minor can't father a child. V'hatana devei Rabbi Yishmael, and here we are at the bright, with a bright at the Academy of Rabbi Yishmael. Ben v'lo av, Torah states that a boy who's a son can become a ben sora more, which implies that one who is a father cannot. V'lo av. Now, the Gemara first explains the Braita. Hey Chidami, what are the circumstances of this case? In other words, in which case is a boy disqualified from becoming a ben sorer more on the grounds that he's a father? Okay? The Gemara suggests one case and rejects it. If you say that it's a case in which a woman conceived from having conjugal relations with a boy who's already produced two pubic hairs, and And she gave birth 9 months later, before the boy's pubic hair comes fully around, remember his member and his scrotum, this implies a boy can become a ben sorer 9 months after entering adulthood. And since the Mishnah states that a boy becomes subject to the law of ben sorer morei upon becoming an adult, it would emerge that there is a 9 month period during which a boy can become a ben sorer morei. Now, what's the issue there? What did the Mishnah say about what the period is?
Between
two pubic hairs and the Zakana Tachton. Okay? Here, she gave birth 9 months later before the beard grew around. What does it imply? Vis-a-vis the boy. Can he or can he not sire children?
He can.
So the implication is that he can sire children. So we have, in essence, the circumstances in which case a boy is disqualified from becoming a ben sorer morei on the grounds that he's a father. So listen to how it continues. Mi ika shehu kulei hai. But is there in fact so much time during which a boy can become ben sorer morei? It's 9 months now that you're talking about it. That he had two pubic hairs, but he didn't have the full other sign.
He could become a father.
And he could become a father. So, that's a full 9 month period of time, right? So from this time onwards, we say yes, he could become a ben sorer morei, but it stops when the baby's born, thusly kind of saying, okay, we use the verse instead of the actual second symbol of the Mishnah to stop the period. And the Gemara kind of here gives us this moment of really having a time frame. 9 months. For this case particularly, we get that sense that there's a period that can be defined. And if we were the rabbis doing our legal parlance, we could now learn from this one case to all cases that we have a definitive 9 month period. Based on the fact that once we saw a case that didn't have the second symbol or sign come in and we had a 9 month period, we can now say that a ben sorer morei, because of this one time when someone had two pubic hairs and then a baby was born, it's 9 months, could say it was 9 months.
But there is a problem, because if the incident is a one-time relation and she goes to a different town, he doesn't know. You don't know that he became a father.
So if it's a one-time instance,
mechanism.
If it's a one-time instance is the interesting part of your question for me. Because the rabbis also want to talk about, what if something's a one-time instance versus, can I look at a one-time instance and say a general rule about it? We know from the Braita of Rabbi Yishmael for a minute, at the end of the sacrifices section of the Siddur, that there are ways to learn from prat to klal, one detail giving me an entire generalization in a category, and from klal to prat, from a generalized way of saying something, I only learn that a very detailed situation either is being discussed or is at law. Hold that thought, because it's going to be tangent to a discussion that comes up in the Gemara very shortly. The interesting part of this limud, this braita, is that instead of now generalizing a general time frame for what a ben sorer's possible period of, what do you call in legal terms the time period in which a person can fit into a legal framework. Is there such a thing in English? I looked this week. In other words, if I say that...
qualification between an interval.
An interval? I wondered if there was a specific legal piece of jargon for this. Because when you say that a person can only be in X category for a certain period of time, like you can be single until you're married, you can be single again after you dissolve a marriage, you can be...
Well, you're a minor until you reach majority.
Is that a legal term in America?
Yeah, because there are things that you do not qualify for, don't apply to you if you're not 18 or if you haven't reached majority.
So do we have a legal term or principle that says that a person is first a minor and then changes status and then becomes of majority?
Is that the parent is responsible for a child, for a minor child.
So that's maybe a status. Mm-hmm. Status under the law, right? Would you say that's a status, a minor status versus?
Yeah.
So we're talking about the status, the statutory period of status for a ben sorer umore.
I'm just curious, the reasoning, like there is no reasoning. A woman becomes pregnant by a minor child.
We don't say he's a minor here, by the way.
What?
He's not a minor. He's got two pubic hairs and he's a bar mitzvah, according to the rabbis.
Right. Two pubic hairs.
He's a bar mitzvah.
The assumption, remember I told you that there's two ways to look at it. If you're only reading the Mishnah and it's two pubic hairs and you didn't have the overarching understanding of Chazal, of the rabbis, that anytime I say two pubic hairs, we're talking about an official bar mitzvah, you might have this debate. Because sometimes we forget that the Mishnah was a text also kind of wavering on interpretation. But the general understanding and our accepted understanding of two pubic hairs and forward is that we're talking about a child who's reached the age of bar mitzvah, and we now check his, you know, if you will, physical signs, and we see that he has two pubic hairs. Okay, so...
He's called a ben sorer umore, so that implies, at least from the discussion with his bread, he's during the period between the first two hairs and the beard all around, he can be brought as a ben sorer umore.
Correct.
And, well, it's complicated. But what I really want to ask was, the logic here... So it says that he's eligible since she gave birth 9 months later and he still hadn't grown his beard all around, the lower beard. Therefore,
the period that he can be a ben sorer umore is 9 months. What's the logic?
Months.
The logic is this. We want to find a way to say there's a statutory period where this person fits into our category of ben sorer umore.
Right.
Thusly, I have a case and I'm going to bring it to you. It doesn't necessarily run like A equals B, therefore B equals C. It's a way of learning. It's a ma'aseh shehaya. Here's a case. And I'm going to put a period of time now based on this case. It's got to be 9 months because you're not going to tell me that this kid deserved anything more than 9 months. That he's going to, now we're going to wait. And plus, I'm going to prove it to you that he didn't have to wait, that the period is 9 months because what? Velo av. The verse says, and he can't be a father. So, I've now given you the status that he ben sorer umore, and this can only be for 9 months. The interesting piece here is that the limud doesn't take. It's not going to be defined as 9 months because what? In the same limud, in the same learning, it says, mi ika shehu kulehai, but is there in fact so much time during which a boy can be ben sorer umore? Do we say that 9 months is a period that we're willing to accept as a time period in which someone could be dragged to the Zakenim, dragged to the elders of the community, and brought up on these charges? V'ha ama Rabbi Kruspadai. We have a learning, we have a lesson in the name of Rabbi Kruspadai. He said in a braita, Kol yamav shel ben sorer more, the entire period of time during which a boy can become a ben sorer more, eino ela shlosha chodeshim bilvad. That there's only a 3-month period in which a ben sorer more can be determined to be a ben sorer more. That's just 3 months. Now, at this point, the Gemara likes this notion of moving the period down, the period of time down, a little bit for some of the reasons we've discussed in class, either discomfort with the reality or the notion that there's an absolute rejection. We're not sure to which level that's going right now. But Rav Kruspadai's limud is what's going to be discovered. Eila lov, rather, is the bright and not discussing a case, so it wants to then purport a different case. Maybe that's not the case at all, where you had the two sarot, the two hairs, and it was that the ben impregnated this woman, and 9 months later she had the baby, and he didn't have his zakan tachton, his lower beard. Here's where it was, de'i'aber mekame delayte shtei sarot, where a woman conceived from a union with a boy at least 6 months before he produced two pubic hairs. Oh, it is now that we're talking about a minor. V'olid mekame delakif zakan, and she gave birth before his pubic beard grew around, during the first 3 months of his adulthood. Is that the case you're talking about? Ushmamina. And what do I then learn from it? Katan molid. That a minor, in fact, can inseminate and father children. And thusly, what? I refute Rabba's assertion. I refute Rabba's position that a minor cannot father a child. Now, they're working pretty hard to do that, but at the same time, we see some of the mechanism of working through the period of time that a person can fall into the statutory category of ben sorer more, which will now become the important learning that's going to happen in a braita that continues. So to defend Rava's position that a minor cannot sire children, the Gemara is going to look at the braita again. Lo, that's not the case we were talking about. You brought me this reinterpreted kind of understanding. La'olam de'i'abar batar de'aiti shtei sarot. Really, the verse refers to a case in which a woman conceived from a union with a boy who had already produced two pubic hairs. Va'oli batar de'akev zakan. And she gave birth 9 months after his pubic beard had grown around.
Where does it say 9 months? How do we know that all this happened the day he had two sarot?
It's not that I have affidavits, but I have the Gemara refuting it, the Stam Gemara, refuting the notion of the reinterpretation of the original understanding of the story.
Okay.
And that ultimately what? What does it ultimately do? It ultimately holds up Rabba's position that a minor cannot sire children. The reason why they're working hard at that could be for two purposes. One, I don't need any text to exempt a minor, remember, from anything. Because the beginning of the whole Talmudic discussion about Ben Sorer More was, you're telling me I need any Torah text to actually exempt a minor from anything? Is there anywhere in Torah that a minor has to be exempted through the use of any midrashic move I make on Torah text itself? I don't need it. So I obviously must be talking about the use of the word ben, son, boy, but not in a way that says he's a youth. It must be a unique use of the word ben, and it's got to be connected to ben sora more, a youth who's rebellious and stubborn. Okay?
Yeah.
Secondly, That was the beginning. If a minor can have children, it upends some of the other law, one of which we saw, remember? Somebody comes to the terms and says, "Oi, I definitely lied, I owe him money, I gotta find the relatives." And what? If it's a minor, what do we assume?
No relatives.
There's no relatives. But if a minor could have children, that whole area of the law is problematic. And already we know sometimes areas of law are problematic one with the other, and that's the job of Tosafot to begin with on a page of Talmud, where they throw one in and says, "Wait a minute, this doesn't go with the other. What do I do?" But over here, they wanted to keep the system relatively similar vis-a-vis Rava's limud. Doesn't mean they're going to come out on his side always. Yeah? Let me push forward with you. And regarding the point of the Braita that was difficult to reconcile with the statement of Rav Kruspedai, that's not difficult. Now, who's this Kruspedai? Kruspedai said in the original that the entire period of time during which a boy became Ben Sora and More is 3 months. Ki ata Rav Dimi Amar, when Rav Dimi came to Babylonia from Eretz Yisrael, he reports the following, Amre b'marava, they say in the West, a reference to Yisrael, because he's in Babylonia and he's talking about what's going on in the West, in Eretz Yisrael.
Southwest.
That Rabbi Yishmael's Braita means as follows. Okay? Here's what it means. Ben v'lo ha-ra'ui likro to'av, a boy who is a son who can become a ben sorer amore, but not a boy who is fit to be called a father. So obviously a boy is a son that we're talking about, but if he's fit to be called a father, then he's excluding him from the potential of being this rebellious son. Now a boy is fit to be called a father as soon as he's been adult for how long?
3 months.
For 3 months. Thus, Rabbi Yishmael's Braita does not contradict Rabbi Kruspedai's rule. It actually provides a scriptural source for what Rabbi Kruspedai stated. So Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Kruspedai agree, 3 month period, for being a ben sorer umore. In terms of analyzing a little bit further, the 3 month period, gufa, you've encountered the word gufa, I'm sure, before in years of limud. We now want to go directly into the kind of insides of this now defined period. The texts of that previously mentioned, right amar, Rabbi Kruspedai amar, Rabbi Shabtai. Rabbi Kruspedai said in the name of Rabbi Shabtai, I'm on 69A3 now. Kol yamav shel ben sorer amore, the entire period of time during which a boy can become a ben sorer amore, einan ela shlosha chodeshim bilvad, is just 3 months. Now, the Gemara challenges that statement. The ha anan tanan, misha yavi shte sarot v'ad sheyakif zakan. But we, in our Mishnah, have two physical symbols. The first two pubic hairs, and the lower fear, the pubic circle. This contradicts Rabbi Kruspedai's assertion that the upper age limit for becoming a ben sorer amore is 3 months past adulthood. The Gemara answers that both age limits are correct. Both age limits are correct. How is it going to do that? He keeps the kan af agav delom malu shlosha chodeshim. The Mishnah teaches that once a boy's pubic beard has grown around, he can no longer become ben sorer amore, even if 3 months hasn't passed. Uh-huh. So now I'll use what you're talking about in that learning over there that the Mishnah provided for us. I'll take Rabbi Kruspedai's learning and I'm going to now reconcile them. 3 months. But if the lower beard comes in before 3 months is done, I'll even shorten the period. Malush losha choshim, afal gav delo hikif. And if 3 months have gone, and he hasn't the lower pubic beard, 3 months, and that's all. You don't need the second son. So Reb Kruzbadai teaches that once 3 months have elapsed since a boy produced those hairs, he cannot become a Ben Sora or a Moray, and that second physical sign doesn't matter any longer. In other words, look down at the note. Once a boy becomes an adult, he is subject to the law of Ben Sora or Moray until his pubic beard grows in or until 3 months elapse, whichever comes first. The Gemara bases the answer on the idea that the term Ben, son, which appears in connection with Ben Sorer Moreh, can be expounded in two ways. Our Mishnah expounds it to mean Ben Velo Ish, a son and not a man. This disqualifies a boy whose pubic hair has grown around, regardless of his age. Rabbi Kruzbadai expounds it to mean Ben Velo Av, a son and not someone who is fit to be called a father. This disqualifies a boy 3 months after he reaches adulthood, whether his beard has grown in or not.
Where does the 3 months come from? What's the basis for 3 months, not 10 months, not 3 years, whatever?
So that's exactly now what fills up some of the discussion in terms of the Gemara. Okay?
How do they reconcile this with the text in the Mishnah itself, which is very specific?
That is the reconciliation, just what happened.
Okay, so until the beard grows around, the lower beard grows fully around, what 3 months, whichever comes first. So the 3 months, which comes before the event of the pubic hairs filling in a complete circle, a contradiction to the Mishnah.
Oh, no. But here's the reality. It on the one hand could sound like a contradiction sometimes. On the other hand, it uses the same verse from Torah in two interpretive fashions to learn out two different ways of approaching the same question. So it's kind of like having original statutory law and then case law that provides you a way of understanding the original statute that now, because of the case law, has interpretive reality in the court. For instance, no immigrant may work on the railroad in the western part of the United States until 1847, when we needed lots of crews and there weren't enough people to be there. And thusly, if your crew was only this many large, and you wanted to lay enough track to meet the deadline of a contract that you had signed, then you could hire X number of new immigrants from the Orient. Right? But wait a minute, didn't I contradict the original statutory immigration law? You did, except that you didn't contradict it. You now had case law, which allowed you to make the law living in its reality. So the same is true vis-a-vis a relationship between Mishnah and what we consider to be hermeneutical reasoning of Amoraim sometimes, except that we're not just talking about hermeneutics, we're talking about cases, even though it's not a courtroom transcript.
Please take your pants off so we can take a look. So we have to practical purposes, say it's a 3-month period.
Wait.
Logical.
It is stated very clearly. We're reading it.
Pardon me?
It is stated clearly. We're reading it. We're regaining the understanding by being in a Beit Midrash and having to see the terseness of the text and the way it was recorded, but it's there in a way that for sure was clearer to Rashi and clearer to that generation of editorial board or Ravasi or whoever really did it in the way that the text is constructed. And
Rav Kuspidai is a Tana from
right. Right. So Rav Kuspidai has this very, very, you know, straightforward.
Okay. So he had a contradictory point of view from whoever, let's say Rav Yehuda Nasi, who codified the Mishnah. There were many possibilities.
Right.
In the Mishnah, he said, "Look, this is the way it is. Two hairs are killed in their bosom."
And then the editor.
Now they're bringing a Braita from which was rejected at the time of the compilation of the Mishnah, but it was not included. And saying this is a really the way things need to be looked at because of whether it's practical considerations or this is the way it works in the real world.
Let me just also say the following. That could definitely be the path and pattern of what happened. There's also another possibility, let's say. The other possibility is that the editors of the Gemara knew full well that still Rav Kuspidai's law held in jurisdiction X, and the Mishnah held in jurisdiction Y, and that at a certain point the harmonization project of the Amoraim and especially the Stamaitic editors was about understanding how the entire oral tradition was understood by people who did know all the laws and had to hold differently. So it's true that it might have been rejected as one possibility and that law was not the statute at the time versus the Mishnaic one. Or that there were many Tanaitic jurisdictions with authoritative legal oral compilations that stood ground. They did not get written down like the Mishnah and the Tosefta, and they did not necessarily even all make it into the project of the editorial board of the Talmud Bavli. So, the question that maybe I didn't hear that you had asked before, but I will say now I think maybe is this one of the things that you might have been asking? Why didn't we just recodify if in fact law developed and we could have some type of new understanding based on other voices and or cases? Codific law writing was not the stylistic norm of the rabbinic culture that grew up in Sasanian Persia. This we know full well. Of law codes that are extant, our Gemara is 3-4 times the size, capacity, and reality of any other of that theater of history's legal documents. That said, some of the greatness of Al-Fassi's work and then ultimately the Rambam's is to get us into a mode of codification and move us into a direction of not writing much like this, but having a world of codific literature as Jews. Maybe for the kind of question, the line of thought that you're asking in your question, because of this kind of parlance here. What was this going to mean for us if a Beit Din needed to now make a law?
I don't know the Hebrew, but I don't. Maybe it has to do with the tense. as it's translated here in the English and the Mishnah, that a son can be declared a ben shor umore. Forgive my pronunciation.
That's good.
Can be essentially. He cannot become one, which is clear, before he grows to pubic hairs. But he can be declared one before a fully developed man whose hair has grown around. So can is the question, not necessarily. So he cannot be one until he has two hairs. According to the English, can, but is not necessarily, is my question, when he has the full beard below. So maybe it's a, you know, it's not an absolute thing. I don't know the Hebrew to translate it. Does that make any sense? Because the cannot is clear. He cannot be one until he has his two hairs. But that he can be up until the point of the beard, but is not necessarily, is what I might infer from the English, but I don't know. The question.
Yeah, that's correct. You have 3 months.
Right, and that's...
And then it's being limited to 3 months.
Right. What do we do with the fact that it's necessarily or not necessarily? Yeah.
Question.
Yes.
I've lost track of why all this is important.
Because they're going to kill your son.
Nope. The mother's going to be pressed.
No,
what's all this feeding
around? I think we feel like right now we're going to a ball of twine. It keeps going around and around. It's a little bit... Okay, rubber band. So we all have the graphic image of what I think we're expressing.
Can I just throw in a comment? In this, I don't know, I'm looking at this commentary here. They're saying something, I don't totally understand it, but it says something basically that, okay, you have the two sorrows, and then, אחר שלושה חודשים אפשר שיהיה לו בן, כיוון שיביא שתי sorrows, he could have the 3 months, he could have a child. אפשר ש... Titaber mimeno isha, a woman could become pregnant by him, ulishlosha chadashim, and in 3 months, yitvar same ha'erayon. It would become public that she's pregnant, because I guess after 3 months it's hard to show. Lufisha bizman hazeh, shar lo lehiot av, so because in this period of time he could be a father, Lo ya'aseh ben sorer moreh, so he can't be a ben sorer moreh after at this point.
That's Steinfeld's narrating it. Yeah, are you in Steinfeld?
I don't know.
What's the
book? This is Talmud. Oh, it's the Talmud. You're reading. From the Rambam. So the Rambam is basically explaining to us the basic narrative of what's now the next little section of the Gemara, which we've yet to just see, which is going to be really that this notion here of 3 months. Like people asked, why the 3 months? Well, I didn't just want to say myself why the 3 months, because the Gemara ultimately is going to answer about the 3 months. Let me get back to this question. What's this? What's this ball of twine? Why do we keep going back? Why do some spots in the Gemara feel like this no matter what Masechet we get to? Why are there 3 pages on whether or not it's really money or it's actually corporal punishment when it comes to Bava Kama and when someone hits their friend? And how many legal ways are you going to do this? And why do some feel like they're better logic? And why do some feel like they're like logic hanging on a wire? Like, wait a minute, you just told me from a case you once heard that someone tied their shoe and then slipped on a marble, and the marble hit a little bit of a pot, and the pot fell off a roof, that I should build a fence around my house, and that means we should all build fences. I mean, the Gemara works like that because of a couple of different reasons. First of all, it wants to indicate that there is a certain slow poetry to human life and civil and legal parlance between people actually unfolds in the small details of what happens in our everyday passings, in our goings and comings, in how we have our belongings, in how we define our relationships, in who we hold accountable for what, in what we hold guilty in our hearts, what we hold ourselves to be innocent with. The Gemara, I believe, is that type of poetry. You know how some poems, you just love poetry, and some people can sit through the recitation of poetry that for all of its stanzas you thought might have said the same thing in one? The difference between some of Byron's longer romantic wanderings and, you know, Darkness, where he sits laughing with his chin on his fist at the world spiraling into nothingness, in enough lines to really show you in this kind of experience of a painting what's going on with the collapse of the world. That to me is the first answer, that there's a certain poetry in this. There's an acquired taste for the poetry of the Gemara that is all about the every interaction. I want this to be as full of Torah as possible, and which verse do I lean on, and how do I really understand it? Secondly is the very project of understanding Torah as a vehicle to move us into defining legal realities is not easy. There's not one accepted way. And they like to include majority and minority voices. And there's a certain amount of steno work in this project that made it the kind of code that I mentioned before, longer and thicker than any of the others from that theater of history. When the court stenographer is said to take dictation, the stenographer takes it all. And though there's an editorial project going on, we got it all. We get the unabridged version. See, if it feels monotonous, my teacher, Rabbi, I think she was going to be a rabbi, she maybe is, maybe is not, so I'll call her doctor, Charlotte von Robert, says that in the culture of the Beit Midrash, the notion of understanding one element of a sugya and one aspect of a limud sometimes drives you through the three that you don't absolutely follow, so that you can re-anchor yourself into the discussion, and then sometime when you step away from the text, the others kind of fall into place. There's a certain kind of pattern of legal reasoning that moves you through the text. I don't know if she would say it exactly like that, so I'll say that I learned that from the way she would approach teaching Gemara sometimes. But that the life of study was so important for the rabbis that they gave this project the bulk, to try to train us into this mode. I think for us, there's also this notion of, I said this the last time, do we learn from life to the Torah, or do we learn from Torah to life? People thought that was a Rosenzweig idea, that he said in his time, he had gone so far away, and he was not in the Jewish fold, and then he was coming back to it, and said, I've now got to bring life to Torah. And this was the famous Rosenzweigian quip among quips that he said. That the rabbis are also struggling with that. Do we take from the fact that we know that a woman will not show for 3 months and put this into our pot and stir it up here to understand how to make laws about women who are pregnant and boys who impregnate them or men who do? Or do we only stick to what the Torah says and our understandings of the words in it? So the next piece kind of takes this 3 months thing, and now we understand where this 3 months piece is from. So let's go there. Bottom of the left-hand column on 69A3. Yatev Rabbi Yaakov min Nahar Pekod Kame de Ravina. When Rabbi Yaakov from Nahar Pekod was participating in a study session held before Ravina, The Yatev Akamar Mishmeh the Rav Huna Bered the Rav Yehoshua, and he sat and said in the name of Rav Huna and the son of Rav Yehoshua, Shema mina mid Rabbi Cruz Padai Amar Rabbi Shabtai. Learn from what Rabbi Cruz Padai said in the name of Rabbi Shabtai. You'll let it l'shiva that a woman, when a woman bears a child in just 7 months, Ein ubara nikar l'shlish yameha. Her pregnancy is not noticeable when 1/3 of her days has passed. Rather, the pregnancy becomes noticeable 3 full months after conception, just as in a 9-month pregnancy. For if you think that a pregnancy is noticeable when 1/3 of her days has passed, lamali l'shlosha, why are 3 months of adulthood needed for a boy to be called a father? I would have said 2 months plus a little bit more is fine.
When did I start counting the pregnancy? What happened to start counting when it begins?
It's a good question back for their time. It really is. But they would figure from the time of the birth, it was 9 months pregnant.
They go backwards.
Okay? So, if Rabbi Kuspidai says in his Limud 3 months, but I know that in reality that there are 7-month pregnancies, he doesn't mean 1/3 of the time only. He means 3 months, because even with a 7-month pregnancy, which they knew by way of phenomenology, that there were 7 months births and there were 9 months births, according to the way that they calculated things, because certain people got married and then they obviously got pregnant at that time, and 7 months later there was a baby.
They knew when they got pregnant, because in the Talmud they discussed 41 days for Mayim Pshutim, so they knew exactly when they got.
Well, I mean, there were definitely some people who believe that they understood a little bit more scientifically, and the Zohar is even closer in understanding the moment. But that's all kind of working backwards a little bit. They feel.
So how did you use 41 days?
That's a question.
So we'll leave that open to who really knew and how. But what we're talking about here is that they're learning from this limud of 3 months of Rabbi Kuspidai that he's not just saying the 1/3 of a pregnancy. He's basically saying at 3 months' time, she shows. And from experience, that means that this Ben, I'm going to start his possibility of being in this moment for only 3 months' time. Because after that, we know he's going to be a father. He's going to be called a father. Amar Lei, Ravina says, Rav Yaakov, La'olam emalach ubara nikar l'shlishi yameha. Really? I will say to you that a 7-month pregnancy is noticeable when 1/3 of her days have passed. Oh, but in my experience, it's going to be a little less. It doesn't have to be 3 months exactly. Still, this has no bearing upon when a boy is fit to be called a father, though, according to our translation. Zeal batar ruba, because we will follow the majority. And as our translation here says, since most women carry their babies for 9 months, we do not consider a boy fit to be called a father until he has been an adult for 3 full months. Note down below. That is, although a 7-month pregnancy becomes noticeable in just 2 1/3 months, the Torah disregards this fact when defining the stage of fit to be called a father, because most pregnancies last for 9 months. Therefore, it defines fitness to be a father as the earliest that a normal 9-month pregnancy would be noticeable if a boy impregnated a woman as soon as he became an adult. This means that a boy is fit to be called a father 3 months after becoming an adult, and that is the upper age limit for being declared a ben sorer more. Rashi sometimes gives us what a basic halachic understanding of the world is, and the piece here, in terms of now this ball, sometimes the ball does go to a place, and you can notice as a teacher that the rest of it before the next Mishnah is also kind of in the same kind of thing, and you can send students home and say, if you like this legal maneuvering a lot, I really bid you some reading on your own in that way, because I'd like to start with the next Mishnah the next time we meet. Which I'd like to. But the piece here that I'd like to focus on is this mention now of this very important concept, Zeal Batar Ruba. Go and let's learn after the majority. Okay? So, they want to say at this stage, we're going to take the normative measure that a woman is pregnant for 9 months. We're going to say for a 3 month period of time she doesn't show. Thusly now, I am able to say a ben sora or mores statutorily, this status can only be for this 3 month period of time. That's basically the Rambam's expression in his commentary there that you read. This is what Rashi said here in our Gemara, and Zil Batar Ruba is the expression. You know, let me read a little bit more back on 69A3 about this expression. Bottom of that right-hand column. Amaruha kame de Rav Huna bere de Rav Yeshua. The rabbis repeated the answer of Ravina before Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yeshua. Amar lehu. And Rav Huna said to them, Uvadine nefashot. Mi azalinan batar ruba? Is it true that in capital cases we follow the majority? In other words, we have a capital case here of potentially putting a ben sora or more to death by stoning. You now told me you have a 3 month period of time in which that person can be called a ben sora or more based on the majority rule. Majority meaning the majority of cases, women are pregnant for 9 months and 3 months they're not showing, and then they are, and therefore I take the 3 months and I've got this period of 3 months. But I described for you a case in which there's a 7th month pregnancy, and after 2 months and a little bit of time, she starts showing, because I proved to you that that's the case. And that limited the period in which I could call this person a ben sora or more, and you're saying that we don't limit the possibility of a capital sentence? In capital cases, I don't just learn general principles from generally the accepted norm, the ruba, the rove, the majority. I want to be able to limit when I apply a capital case. HaTorah Amra v'shaftu ha'eda v'hitzilu ha'eda. In fact, I have two verses that come in Numbers 35, one after the other, that you just and judge the people, you justly judge the people, and you v'hitzilu ha'eda, and the congregation you shall save, you shall rescue, you shall work to rescue them. The fact that these two verses come close to each other means in my judging and in my authority to judge, I have to do everything I can to possibly save life. And in capital cases, if I could limit the period of time even further, I should have to take that kind of limitation very seriously. V'at amrat zil bat haruba, and you're still going to hold that you go after this kind of majority rules, in this case meaning a statistical majority that I've noticed of women's pregnancies and how long they last and the period of time that I now say this ben sora can be a ben sora more. So again, this concept of going after the ruba, going after the statistical majority, the statistical reality of most cases, there's also in it the kind of legal echoes of the whole question of our approach to majority rule and the questions we have about what happens when the majority goes one way versus another way. And it's at this moment in the sugya, instead of the legal haranguing that they're giving each other and all the details of the legalities and the this many months and that many months, that the deeper question of what if the majority actually wants to reject this whole concept of ben sorer more to begin with, in our time perhaps, if you want to either delimit it? Or what do we do in cases where we have a majority inclining one way of justices, judges, versus a minority, as we've had case to recall in other parts of our Masechet, of Sanhedrin? How do we deal with minorities and majorities? And how do we let them into the legal decisions we have at any given stage, or do we not let them into any legal decisions we have to make? In this case, we're making a decision about a period of time for a ben sorer more. It seems very serious. It's a capital case. There are other capital cases where we have to decide whether or not this principle actually pertains or not. So, in general, this mention leads the Gemara to wonder whether or not in capital cases at all we really are going to invoke this principle of after the majority we incline. And that whole principle really comes in a different section of Gemara that I want to show you. I made copies of a daf in Chulin. Have you learned Chulin at all throughout the years of Talmud class?
Yeah.
Yeah, Chulin is all about slaughtering and kosher meat. Two years ago? So this is from Chulin, and whenever the discussion of whether or not you kind of go with the majority comes along, there's one sugya in Chulin that people refer to, and it's this sugya. It lasts for about two pages. But there's one particular part of the sugya which, you know, is always interesting because people of right kind of outlooks can see that the reasoning is somewhat suspect, actually. I wonder what you think of it. And yet, you know, there's a certain reality here that it kind of gives you the benefit of the doubt and allows you to operate in life based on the kind of reality that the Gemara imagines, and that is that you're living in a Jewish world, you're living with Jewish laws around you, you're living with people who respect the law, and it wants you to, you know, chai behem, as you will, the Torah says, live by them, live with them, live by the mitzvot. So, look at it.
We're using the same term, live by the
mitzvot. Right. So that's why I brought us the piece. So look at 11a1, left side of the page. Having discussed the scriptural source for chazaka, the Gemara seeks the source for another fundamental legal principle. Minaha milta de'amar rabbanan. From where in scripture do we learn this thing that the rabbi stated? Zil batar ruba. Follow the majority. Okay? The Gemara objects to the question. Okay, so it says, hold on one sec. Yeah, there's a little bit of a mistake in the Hebrew on that column. Just, it's instead of malanan, it's minalan. Okay, minalan. From where, do you ask? Or, in other words, this is the tone. Minalan. You're asking Minalan. And by the way, I also brought it because of this very kind of thing. Where else did we see that same question? We saw that about the miners at the beginning of our sugya. Minalan, you're asking for a source that proves that minors are exempt? Was there ever a source in Torah that made minors responsible for anything, that I had to reject the responsibility through any proof of a Torah verse? In other words, same thing here. After the majority inclined, you're really asking me that question? And the rabbis, as a principle, sometimes question their own hermeneutical situation. It's kind of like internal, somewhat, humor. But humor in a very sophisticated way. Continuing. Dichtiv, acharei rabim lahatot. For it's obviously known from that which is written, incline after the many. Acharei rabim lahatot. We have a verse that specifically says in Exodus 32:2 that after the majority, one must stand. And it reads like this, the verse. Lo tihye acharei rabim lara'ot. Don't go after the majority to do any evil. Velo ta'ane al riv limtot, and don't make any fraudulent kind of thing happen because of that. What do? Acharei rabim lahatot. But you shall not respond over this dispute to tilt after the many. You simply will go after the majority, though, to bring about, in a certain way, the kind of justice that the majority holds. In other words, let me read you the verse again. You shall not go after the many to do any bad, and don't respond to a dispute just to tilt after the many, but do consider the majority. So the Gemara ultimately wants to be clear what that means, after the majority you shall incline. The next piece is only one of many more, as I said, but here's the very famous spot. Ruba de Itakaman, concerning a majority that is in front of us, I'm on the right-hand column now of the page I handed out. Kagon Tesha Chanuyot the Sanhedrin, for example, 9 kosher stores that constitute a majority, or a majority of the judges on the Sanhedrin. That's a majority that you can really trust. Lo kami bayalon, we're not inquiring. Surely the verse just quoted is the source that we rely upon such a majority. Ki kami bayalon, rather, when did we really inquire? Ruba de late kaman, we're concerning a majority that's not in front of us. Kagon katan ukitana, as in the case, for example, where a boy and a girl who are minors perform yibum. Looking at the note, when a man dies childless, the Torah requires that a surviving brother marry the widow through yibum, and yibum's special exception to the general law forbidding cohabitation between a man and his brother's wife on pain of karet. The Torah stipulates that the purpose of yibum is to lahakim lachav shem, to establish a name for his dead brother, produce a child who will carry on his dead brother's memory. Thus, in order for yibum to be effected and permitted, both the widow and the brother must eventually be capable of reproducing. The above stipulation figures in a case where yibum was performed, but the surviving brother and or widow was a minor. In that case, there is some question as to whether the yibum is effective and thus permitted, since it cannot be known now whether the brother and or widow will eventually be capable of reproducing. For any boy might be a sari, a male incapable of maturing sexually. Okay? So, again, you have this internal system where the minor doesn't produce children, either. We don't assume it. So, what are the cases? We obviously now have inclined after a majority of the cases that are things right in front of our faces. And we have the case of the statistically unknown, or the statistically thought to be known, but really unknown in this particular case. The things in front of us are the cases of A, the stores, the nine stores, and B, the majority of justices on a Sanhedrin, and the statistically unknown particular case of the Yibum, though you're telling me that you might think about knowing the general statistical reality of the possibility that most women and men can sire children, let's say. Back to the first two, the ones in front of us. What's the case of the nine stores? So if I live in a town, and there are nine kosher butchers, and I get my meat at any which kosher butcher. I go there. One time I'm coming home, Shabbos is coming, I know that I'm responsible to get the chickens. I'm passing this direction first time that I got my goods that I'm going to sell the shuk next week from this mocher, from that seller. I come back in town, there's a butcher over here, not the one I usually go to. It's the 10th store, if you will. It's the 10th. These other nine, they're known. What's the assumption based on Zil Batar Ruba? After the majority we incline? It's kosher. So that principle obviously does not take into account, let's say, New York City in the year 2013 and Jews living in metropolitan centers, even perhaps Middle Ages. Maybe it means Jews living in closer quarters in ancient times, within city limits that are defined by areas of, you know, Tchum Shabbat, the area in which one may do any given activities or carry, depending on where an Eruv is, or outside of the city limits, and how far can you go, and how these are defined areas. But that kind of logic actually permits me to get the kosher food I need, to bring my meat home, to prepare for Shabbat in time. It, in essence, allows me to incline after the majority. The majority that's in front of me. Sound safe? Sound like a good way of thinking? Sound like a reasonable way of approaching the question so central to Torah living? You know, don't eat non-kosher. It's an abomination. And by the way, a major sin for which you'll have to bring offerings?
Are you looking for an answer?
Yeah. No, I'm not being rhetorical. Does it sound like a feasible way of thinking about fulfilling what we, even if we have to put ourselves into the shoes of the rabbis? Here are mitzvot that we take really seriously. There are nine kosher butchers. We take kosher meat really seriously. I can assume the tenth is fine because of the legal principle of zeal bat aruba.
Yeah, but I think it's reasonable.
Yeah?
It's a chance you take, so it's not a capital issue. I think that's...
No, I would take the chance because it's statistics. Okay, you know the truth. Okay, the most likely truth. Okay, that if it rained today, in the absence of knowing anything else, okay, the guess that it's going to rain tomorrow is your best bet.
Yeah, but the consequences of being wrong are quite serious. So I'm not sure.
Wouldn't it depend on the circumstances? If you went into a store, if you had shopped there previously, you know, of course, if you hadn't,
your responsibility to make sure it's kosher. And if you were invited to a dinner or a friend's whatever, and you sit down to eat and you say, where did you get this chicken, if I may ask? I don't know if the maid bought it and she prepared the dinner. That's a different circumstance. Now, maybe he didn't give specific instructions, but the odds are so heavily in favor of his having been purchased in a kosher butcher that you might say, for many reasons, you should eat it.
So the rule doesn't mean we abrogate personal responsibility.
I would think not. I don't know what.
So it's a good point. And the fact that we take this chance because, yeah, it seems like in this town, nine others really follow
this.
Still
without propensity to
take
risk.
I don't buy it like that. Mm-hmm. I don't agree. Nine can be kosher and one is not kosher. A city has 90% Jews, 10% are not Jews. So you cannot pick up somebody and say, you're Jewish now. So the Zil Bataruba doesn't, or if you have nine women, nine is the 9 months pregnant and the other eight are not, you are not going to have nine babies 9 months from now. So the majority doesn't rule.
Okay. Well, what were you going to...
Well, it's just the same. I mean, I think we're all agreeing that it's not an assumption that you can make. It's a chance you take that may or may not be reasonable depending on your comfort level about eating non-kosher chicken. But what's at stake, however serious, is less than someone's life. Right, so, you know, I might be afraid to eat, but, you know, that's my decision.
Let me put something else on the table that might be at stake. We're doing a legal exercise here. It's a Beit Midrash. I don't have hard fast answers sometimes to these kinds of questions that I'll end up with. Someone saying Kaddish, and in some Jewish legal circles, who even take the law seriously. We've identified major legal Jewish principles by which we can operatively look at life and situations and apply Talmudic reasoning to other kinds of situations that weren't necessarily mentioned. Nine people are in a Beit Knesset. One of those already has the obligation for Kaddish. Those people know each other. Someone else comes in these days, in our time, walks in, is the 10th soul, with respect for whomever they are. They might be journeying to learn all about our tradition and have greatest respect in the world for Torah. Do we say Zil Batar?
No.
Ruba.
But these are all examples of actually things that are before you. You're coming to a store and you're saying, well, I'll assume it's kosher because nine others are. But you can go in and you can inspect. In this example, you can ask the person. But the example I thought here, which is very important, what the rabbis whom we follow, we're not allowed to make up our own view about what we think, that they're saying there's some meat that you find, which you can't ask the piece of meat, are you kosher or not? It's a question of whether it came from the nine or it came from the one that's known to be not kosher. So the rabbis are saying, follow the rule of the majority. You're not going to know one way or the other. So we say, it's okay to eat that.
Right.
Because you assume it's kosher. As opposed to today's world, where, and we should be able to point this out to the rabbis in parts of the city and places in Israel, where they're saying, no, everything has to be the most extreme, you know? You can't take a chance. Our tradition says it's much more important to never eat, even if you're trying to follow the law.
Mm-hmm.
There's a chance that you're going to find a little tiny microscopic microbe of a tiny shrimp in your tap water. You can't use brush your teeth.
Right.
Okay, where did they get that idea?
Right.
This is saying, no, you have to follow the majority.
Nice application. That is the equal and opposite. There is a certain giving this to taking and knowing that you're really keeping mitzvot here. You're not questioning whether or not this piece of meat came from the one kosher store, the one non-kosher store in the place. You trust that this banquet in front of you is all from the kosher stores in your town, because in front of you were nine kosher butchers, and you move forward and you, in simcha, go eat.
And you're confusing two things between majority rule of decision-making and majority fact of physical establishment.
But it's not necessarily a confusion. It's not necessarily confusion, because both are at stake. Because when I have majority rule of justices trying to create some type of saktin, some type of legal decision-making, I'm also talking about one particular instance and opinions of those justices on a court, and having to make decisions between majority and minorities.
Stop is not an opinion.
And, well, in a certain way, you can't learn exactly one to the other, right? But in a majority-minority kind of way, we say, if there's justice and rightfulness in going with either the opinion or the statistical probability, go that direction.
It was a parallel that we learned in this tractate when we discussed it, is that there was a situation where could you assume the meat was kosher, was shechted correctly if you didn't see the shechter do it? And the decision, I thought, was that you could, if you didn't have a reason to believe it wasn't done correctly, okay, then you should accept it as being done correctly. And I would think that that would be a corollary to this case, okay? If we had no reason to believe that the 10th store was not kosher and the 9 stores was, it was a good assumption to assume that the 10 was kosher.
Yeah. And so the reality about the stores is one situation that I created. It's true, Dan, that the one potential understanding of the Gemara is a little bit more clearly based in the 10 pieces of meat in front of me and my questioning the piece of meat. But I think in this case, it's the same about the stores as it is with the chef, with the butcher.
But you can't eat the ham in the 10th store on the theory that, well, it's probably kosher.
No, you can't, and that's where we never say that someone abrogates the personal responsibility to actually know that it's within my city limit and that these are Jewish people as well and that this is a place of business that I can trust in a certain sense. And so we're not taking it that far, and we know it only goes so far. So good. Last point of the night, and then we'll say Laila Tov. When it comes to this other example of Yibum and marriage and whether or not, that's my 9:29:30. When it comes to this other piece of the marriage and whether or not this is going to actually lead to children or not, we generally hold that yes, it's fine, right? Unless we can ultimately discover that some way of giving a more lenient view becomes the reality. Ultimately, we go after the majority if there's, in essence, statistical justice in it. And if there's a way to investigate further and find within a situation a way to create a leniency or to not ultimately sentence someone to death or to reduce the potential of any negative type of any negative type of reality, then we want that majority to influence and impact our reality. Vladimir. Yeah, I went and